Welcome to Nature Knows, conversations with wild warriors and change makers. I'm your host, Jen Vitanzo, and this podcast is all about nature, both the wild kind outside our front doors and the humankind written within our DNA. Each episode showcases an individual who has dedicated their efforts to create a better today to ensure we have an actual tomorrow, and they are using their unique creative fingerprints to do it. These are the wild warriors and change makers constructing the bridges necessary to connect us all, human to human, species to species, worlds to worlds. Hi, and welcome to today's podcast. Our guest today is Kelly Burke, who is a systems engineer for a defense company, who also happens to be an amazing green thumb and a pretty phenomenal tailor, proving the point that you are never just one thing. The conversation ranges from baby bat butts to exploding flower to building your own robot. I hope you get something good out of it. Thanks for tuning in. Kelly Burke, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. So Kelly, you're an engineer.
Yes.
Okay, tell us a little bit about your area of engineering.
So I'm in systems engineering now, but I kind of got there through a roundabout path. So I graduated with a bachelor's in chemical engineering, and I did process engineering manufacturing support for about 6 years. But that's a whole different animal as far as engineering goes. A lot of manufacturing support, you're on call harder all of the time. So if you're in a small plant like I was for 4 years, I was on call 24/7, 365 days a year for 3 years.
Wow.
Which is exhausting. So after I'd done that, and I tried quality engineering for a little bit and didn't really, that wasn't really the spot for me, I didn't think. So through some networking, I got into systems engineering, which is kind of similar to process engineering, but more on the design end rather than on the keeping a manufacturing plant up and running end.
Okay. So if you were just like someone who has no idea what any of that stuff is in terms of what a system engineer essentially, like the day in a life, like what are you designing?
So systems engineers are the ones kind of sitting there trying to keep all the other engineering groups together and on the same page and meeting the customer needs. So like,
so you
the easiest, no, go ahead.
I said, so you heard cats.
Yeah, somewhat. Thankfully it's not a ton of it. Cause you're also, I mean, I guess a little bit, but, you're just kind of thinking big picture. So like if you were to start with designing a house ground up, you've never built a house before, you know, systems engineering is the people coordinating, you know, your plumbing needs to come in and not interfere with your electrical and not interfere with, you know, where your wall supports need to be. It's the people coordinating all of that together to make sure that everything cooperates and runs correctly and meets the customer needs, which in like the case of a house might be like actually having running water in all your bathrooms and, you know, AC or heat or that sort of thing. So, there's a whole like systems engineering V, that they call it, but it basically goes down starting from like what the customer wants and then what's required based on what the customer wants. And then you get into the design stuff, which would be working with the electrical, you know, mechanical people to make sure that their design meets the requirements. Mm-hmm. And then you go up the other side of the V. You can just Google systems engineering V. There's lots of images. You get into integration. So that'd be like when you're actually building it, putting it all together, making sure it all cooperates like your design thought it would. And then you get into testing it. So, you know, if you open the taps, does your water actually run? Did you hook everything up correctly? And then delivery after that, it's, you know, maintenance. So that's, you know, your toilet's leaking a little bit. That's, you know, that's the maintenance end of things, which is where systems engineering is pretty much ducked out and most companies by that point.
Got it. That's cool. So basically you're like the cruise ship coordinator. Well, in a sense of you basically hold it together. Like you are the overview. You are like this part needs to talk to this part needs to talk to that part. Which actually, when you're talking about any system, right? You need to have all the parts talking to each. And it's so interesting that so much of what we're seeing now is a lot of silos and closed, like they're not talking to each other.
Yeah.
A lot of industries that aren't talking to each other, a lot of just, and even within industries, parts of the industries that aren't talking to each other and like the breakdown that that creates.
Right. So systems engineering's whole goal is to try and prevent that and get people out of their silos and aware of what everybody else is doing and make sure that it's still going to meet what the customer wanted at the very end.
Right. So if you were to compare yourself to like a system, essentially any system, I guess you'd be like an ecosystem.
I'm everything.
You're an ecosystem. Yeah.
Specifically, I write requirements in my current role. So, I'm a subset in the systems engineering world, but I touch other parts, obviously. But most of my day-to-day job is writing the requirements.
Got it. That's pretty cool. That's got to be a lot of juggling. You have to have a knowledge basically of all engineering then.
Yeah, I like it. One of the reasons I chose it is because it's a broad knowledge of all engineering, but you're not the one going deep in and, I'm not making CAD drawings of electrical systems or mechanical, I have a broad knowledge of everything. I have to have a general idea in my role of like communications, electrical needs, mechanical, and then just general, like what the customer needs, like how much space do I need to put this piece of equipment in, like we spec all that out. So it's a broad engineering, like you can get deep within systems engineering, but overall I think of systems engineering as the broad overview of, I don't have to have a ton of mechanical engineering knowledge, thankfully.
Right. Well, that's good. That's actually great because one of my closest friends is actually, she's a structural engineer. Her focus has been bridges, but she's branched out from that because she's got a great business acumen as well. And so she's actually turned her business into helping connect departments of transportation with technology that will help them solve their building needs, their transportation needs, particularly with bridges. It's pretty fascinating. I remember I one time took some photos for her of one of the project sites that she was on and like all the tech that she was working with. And I was like, I have no idea what any of this stuff does, but it's really interesting that it all just works. And it just understanding torsion and this and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, this is a whole other world for me. But then you start seeing it, like you said, it's in different systems. It's not like we think of it just as it's engineering and it's math and it's this. But at the same time, it's like a system is a system is a system. So whether right. your system is in your computer and it's a system that's all the parts need to be talking to each other. Mm-hmm. So you have that, or a system of a family, and understanding people's dynamics and how everything works together, or, a business, or, how a pond ecosystem works. So you do this, but you also have all these other cool hobbies.
I do. So most of them are like sewing related. So I quilt, I sew clothing. I made this dress today. I didn't make it today. I made it a few weeks ago, but the dress I'm wearing today I made. I cross stitch. I do a little bit of embroidery and crochet. I briefly tried to pick up knitting, but that's gone on the wayside because it's complicated and I have too many hobbies. When I want to relax, I paint a little, but I haven't yet invested into oil paints to follow Bob Ross. So I mostly do watercolors because those were a cheap investment and didn't involve like prepping canvases or whatever the heck oil paints involved. That looked complicated.
Yeah, which by the way, though, oil watercolor is super hard. Like it is, I have a design background and I had to do all of that stuff. Watercolor was my least, I love it. I love it. It's beautiful, but it was my least favorite medium to work with because I was like, I would constantly be just making giant blotches all over because I was like, this is just so precise and I am so not precise.
There's a bunch of YouTube tutorials now that make it fairly easy, but I think the thing I've learned most in my brief watercolor journey is to like, you really actually do have to step away and let things dry. And I think that's the hard part. So you're like, oh, I just want to continue. But if it's still wet and you need it to be dry, then that's when your paint looks messy real fast.
Yeah, I think that's part of my problem with it is that I'm like, I got to finish this. I got to move on to the next thing. And I'm like,
watercolor waits for, right. It's not going to let you do that. I also bake. So, to round out the house skills and gardening now that it's warm out.
They're all like, it's amazing how like they're,
obviously super functional, you know, like real world applications, super functional. Like, Kelly, if the apocalypse happens, you were the person I'm calling. You will keep my alive and clothed.
My first job was with a glass company. So they had I was near the Corning Museum of Glass, and they have glass blowing classes. So I briefly took some glass blowing classes, but then I moved away from the area. So I used to be like super useful in the apocalypse because everyone still needs jars and stuff, right? I mean, I guess all the jars we already have will break immediately, but
we'll be one in the time we need it. That's really cool. But I love that. I love practical, because I think we've gotten so dependent upon technology, and technology is fantastic for so many reasons. But I feel like so many people have gotten away, like, especially like I look at my nieces and nephews, and they're such smart, clever little kids, but they're so glued to their screens. And if you ask them to step away and have to do something without Googling it first, they wouldn't. It's not even like they wouldn't even think to be like, I'll figure it out. You know, it's like, I just go to Google and I figure, you know, I just, and I just find like the real world stuff is so, it's so handy to have. And there's something that's really, I don't know, this might be just me, but fundamentally satisfying about being able to make something with your hands.
Like, oh no, absolutely. Like, right? When, like, I go into work and I'm like, no, I made this one. Like, yes. Like, it's just like way more like you have something physical to show off and like view. Whereas like, you know, my other hobby, video gaming, you're like, yeah, I beat the boss this weekend. Like, there's nothing, like, it's not as exciting as going into work and being like, yeah, I made this.
I know, but there's something also very, like, I don't know if it's that, I've always found that, like, when I was living in South Africa, working in the field, actually working in the field, and like hands getting dirty, having to, like, we were literally digging up ground to create gardens and building things together. And there was something just, again, so satisfying about the work that you put in and then the reward of your work, like things would grow or, you know, or things didn't because warthogs were, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just, and I always wonder how much we were actually sort of punishing kids growing up for not having as much of that. Like, in certain areas, absolutely, it's always going to be a way of life. But I feel like we've created so much of a society that keeps pulling away from having kids literally get their hands dirty, you know?
Yeah. And I think it pulls both ways too, because there's a lot of encouragement of like, oh, great, you learned to program early, you're always going to have a job. But that just, I don't know, I feel like that puts a whole nother emphasis on, I'm a firm believer of your hobbies should not be what you do for day to day. Most people don't want to day to day. There's a subset that manage it, but most people don't want to be doing their hobbies as a career. So like, if you say, oh great, they've learned to program, but you haven't given them other hobbies, and then, you know, their hobbies are like their job too, you never get a mental break, no, you know? No. I like to be able to turn off, you know, I'm on vacation. Great. Now I'm going to go do things that are completely unrelated to my job. And I'm going to forget about my job for a week.
That's actually how it ended up. The reason I ended up leaving music initially in the first place, the first time around, was essentially because I couldn't escape. It was constant. I was like, woke up in the morning and everything was about music, and went to bed at night, every single day of my life, 24/7. And I was like, I can't, like, my brain is going to melt out of my ear. I just need space. And the hard thing is, when you're an entrepreneur, you're working for yourself, you don't, you every day you take off, you're like, but I should be working because I need to make money and I need to like build my career because I don't have like a regular whatever to go to. But at the same time, everybody needs that detox. Everybody needs to step aside and get up. And I always worry about like people not being able to actually interact with people in one-on-one circumstances, and where it's like they don't get to read each other's facial expressions, where they don't actually get to like lean on someone's shoulder or whatever, and how that actually affects, you know, your development, your social skills, your whatever, and your connection to everything. It's like, when we're sort of tapped in, because we're tapped into sort of like the matrix, so to speak. How does that affect our actual interpersonal skills in general? Like our own physical, like our health, our emotional health, our emotional well-being, because there's so much more to be said about it being in person and doing something with somebody.
And I feel like we're all feeling that right now. Like, especially, you know, like I'm lucky enough to live here with my husband, but if it wasn't with him, it'd be me alone in a house most days of the week. Cause I'm not going into work most days, like not seeing anybody, not talking to anybody. Like, it's gotta be really hard right now for anybody living alone. But I feel like, we're just kind of like, we've all just been plopped into a giant experiment of like, how much can we all live through our screens? And it's hard.
And live with ourselves too, though. That's the other thing, is I think we've had such an opportunity to step away from ourselves in a lot of ways because we have all these distractions, which are amazing in small doses, but when they're consistent, like you never actually get time to just be with you. Like you were saying, like you find another hobby that's not your job so that you get that downtime to keep decompress. Like we're constantly on. We are plugged in constantly. We are like, we don't even get, like, I think so many jobs now too, it's like you're on call 24/7. Like you said, so many jobs, they're like, well, you're expected to answer calls on, even if you're in sales, you're expected to answer a call on Saturday at any time of the day or night and Sunday, and you're expected to be available. And it's like, well, when do you get time to just like process and breathe, you know?
Right. Yeah. I think that's been a huge issue with cell phones. Cause before cell phones, especially smartphones with email access, you know, like, on-call engineers weren't nearly as available. Like pagers started it, but you know, like if you called the house and you know, you were off the neighbors or the pool or whatever, if you were an on-call engineer, they just missed you and they had to wait or call somebody else. Whereas when I was an on-call engineer with a smartphone, I was always checking my email. I'd check it last thing before I went to sleep, first thing when I'd wake up to see what happened, plus the 3 a.m. phone calls. Like it's not fun. fact that now my job, I don't have a work phone, has been fantastic. And I think that we really need to look at how many people really do you really need to be calling on a weekend, and can you set up a schedule so it's like, all right, you've got 8 people in the department. You're only on call or expected to be available one weekend every 2 months or something, you know, to spread out that burden.
Right.
Whereas like right now, like my boss has a cell phone. I don't think he gets weekend calls much, but because the nature of my job, but you know, like he's the only one. So if I was in a different type of department, it'd all be funneling to him. It's not a life.
Yeah.
It's rough.
No, it isn't, because you never get time to unplug. You literally never get time to breathe and feel like you have your own space. You feel like you're constantly at someone else's sort of beck and call.
Yeah.
And that's hard.
Yeah.
So, but you were saying before we were chatting before with texting and stuff, but like connecting the stuff that you do to sort of a broader picture. What did you find anything? Anything exciting you want to share?
Oh, I was looking up stuff for like kids resources. Is that what you're asking?
Yes. Sorry.
No, that's fine.
I'm not clear if I just said that actually. Sorry.
No. So at a like high schooler level probably is where I'd start with this. MIT has that open courseware stuff. They have some systems engineering classes. Unfortunately, their undergrad intro to systems engineering isn't like the lectures aren't available online, so you can't watch them. You can just like read the PowerPoints. But the intro or the fundamentals of systems engineering course for graduate, it looks like it's probably the starter graduate in systems engineering. That one's available. I think there's 11 or 10 or 11 of the video lectures of the 12 lectures. Or online. So if you are like a high school student and you're thinking systems engineering sounds interesting, you can always, you know, even it, you know, increase the speed, watch those, get an idea for systems engineering. Right. But systems engineering isn't normally an undergrad degree. So I think in general, if you're watching this as a parent or, you know, a middle school kid or something interested in it, just the general engineering resources to kind of experiment with engineering at home. So I know like Discovery, and I can send you the link, but they have a whole series right now actually called At Home Engineering, which I think is probably recent.
Discovery Channel?
No, this is a different Discovery. It's Discover and then just the letter E. So I think it's meant to stand for Discover Engineering.
Okay.
But they I was reading the thing because I actually didn't know that they existed before this week. They do like classes and stuff, theoretically, like people can volunteer to run like in their middle school or whatever, like classes. So they have them separated out by grades. They had like an elementary school set, a middle school set, and a high school set, but they've got different like design challenge type things. So I'll give you the link to that website as well, because it's just like a lot of them look like you could do at home, and they aren't really set up, a lot of them, to be done without an engineer kind of leading you through, but kids are smart now, they can Google. So like when it says, you know, learn about this concept, you know, they can Google around and find out hopefully something about the basics. But at the end of the day, they were design challenges, like, can you support textbooks on these like sheets of paper type things? And I'm assuming it was cardboard. I didn't look super closely at that one. But so like there's little things like that that are just an intro to engineering, as well as, I will say, learning the program in general is fairly useful in most engineering disciplines at this point. So, and there's a ton of resources for that.
Yeah, there's a whole programming camp. Isn't there
there's a bunch of them.
Yeah.
As well as my nephew has, there's a little, it's called a Piper computer.
Yeah.
But he literally, it's a Raspberry Pi, those little like mini computer processor things.
Right.
He literally built a little tiny computer with the Piper kits. They're not cheap, I will say that. It was a couple $100, I think, but he got that for Christmas one year, and he literally like wired it up, and it gives you very clear instructions, but he was literally plugging in the wires and building and connecting so his mouse would work, so he had buttons that would work, so his keyboard would work.
Oh my gosh.
So, then within that, there's programming, and then they have a whole special, like they worked with Minecraft, they have a whole special Minecraft thing for learning.
Okay.
For that Piper computer. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that is wild. Yeah, I think the one that, I think there's like a, well, I'll see if I can find it on here. Kids That Code or something like that. Words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a high school level, there's also FIRST Robotics, which is just like club teams, like high school club teams,
right,
where you're building robots. So, you know, we all wanted to do that.
So
or maybe that was my group of friends.
No, actually, I was fascinated by that stuff too. And I'm like the most useless person when it comes to any sort of mathematical. I mean, I was fascinated by math. I like one of the few people that I think that loved calculus and I loved physics. Like I loved the combination of like math and real world physics stuff, but I was terrible at it. I was interested in it, but I was like, I'm still not good. Like, I kind of get it, but not well enough to be like, I'm good at this. I should do
math. Math is actually my worst subject.
Is it really? Yeah, I'm like kind of like the overview, seeing how things connect, sort of like a systems, like that's how my brain works. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the detail part of the actual logistical, how this functions on a mathematical level, you know.
As soon as you introduced calculus into physics, I managed it when I had to. I was thankful that's part of why I was in chemical engineering, because you don't have to do all the physics math weirdness, you know, you have to learn organic chemistry instead, which is a whole different beast of memorization, but yeah, I knew how to memorize.
People don't become doctors. That class is legit the reason a lot of people do not become doctors.
Yeah, my organic chemistry prof failed like 50% of the class.
Ooh, that's rough.
For the first semester, and then we got a new professor for the second semester, and I think for a while he wasn't the first one wasn't allowed to teach undergrads because we all complained so much.
Yeah, that's rough. That's rough though. Like, why? I never understood why there are teachers that will do that. I'm like, why would you crush someone like that? Like, why? Inspire them and boost them and help them. And
well, I think that's an issue with just how most of the higher education system in the U.S. is set up anyway. Is all the professors are encouraged and then they get all that money by doing their research and stuff. So they're not necessarily passionate about teaching the students how to learn these subjects. They want to do their research, and as a qualification to do that, they have to teach undergrads.
Got it.
So I think that's a little bit of a, I've talked about that before with people. I think engineering classes are great on teaching you kind of how to think like an engineer. They don't prepare you at all for what engineering actually is. Like they're much more setting you up in case you want to go get your master's, your PhD or whatever, and then go into engineering. but and as an undergrad graduating, going straight into the workforce, the best class I had was safety, which at the time I was in my chemical engineering program wasn't a required class. But I think they've changed the accreditation requirements so that way now there's a process safety class for chemical engineers.
Thankfully. Oh my God, I think that'd be like the number one thing that they would have you do.
It was super interesting. So like you're studying all these horrible disasters, but like you're just, it was a learning, like what went wrong, why you should listen, you know, like here's the, you know, OSHA stuff that you really should think about. And, you know, there's a lot of, especially in manufacturing engineering, you know, and even in design engineering, but you see it day to day in manufacturing engineering, there's a lot of safety things to think about that like,
yeah.
I mean, how many of us have gone up onto the roof to clean the gutters or whatever with no one watching the ladder or whatnot? Like, you're also supposed to inspect the ladder before you use it. You're supposed to do all these things that, like, unless you're in a manufacturing plant, OSHA is going to fine you if you don't do them, people don't think about.
Right. Yeah. We ran into that a lot in the bush, which was like a whole, it's like the Wild Wild West too, to a large degree. But interestingly enough, in some places, the safety was huge because you're dealing with not just like, you know, if the ladder fails, that's a problem. If the ladder fails and there's some lions sitting under you, that's a whole other, the whole introducing some more issues into the. And also, you know, you were in, if you got injured, you were injured in a place where you weren't near anything. So right. The closest hospital could be 5 or 6 hours away. You might have to be airlifted. And so you had to like, there were certain things that they were super stickler, which is great. You know, it's like, I'm the first person to be like, I like adventure, but I'm like the weird person who's like, I like adventure, but I'm all prepared. You know, I'm like, but yeah, it's pretty interesting. And I'm surprised that safety wouldn't have been like a fundamental course you had to take as part of the requirement.
I know, especially for chemical engineering, because right. There's so many things that can go wrong in chemical engineering. Like, I think it's not light reading. I think anyone who becomes a chemical engineer should read. There's a book about the Bhopal disaster, which was a huge chemical, I want to call it an explosion. It's not really an explosion. A chemical leak in Bhopal, India. They killed, I don't remember how many people, but it's a whole summary about, the book goes through the timeline, what went wrong, what happened, you know, it gets into the culture of why it eventually got to the point where this chemical was a big chemical cloud into the air and then the after effects on the people. And I think that books like that should be required in reading for chemical engineers to remember that when you don't follow a safety thing, yeah, one thing probably won't blow up at the plant or whatnot, but if everyone doesn't follow one thing, you've suddenly killed thousands.
Yeah, you've got a major domino effect. That's so true. It's like Chernobyl, all those places, Chernobyl, and it's like something goes wrong, and whether it was human error or whatever, but just not being, it's so easy to overlook one little thing and be like, it's fine or whatever. And then the next person does it somewhere else. And then all of a sudden this whole snowball effect, and suddenly you've like, everything's glowing green and people are just sort of dissolving, you know, and everything else is just falling. I mean, it's crazy how quickly too, and chemical engineer, especially chemical, just in the name, chemical.
Well, it's funny because there's a lot of things that people don't think are dangerous. But one of the things in my process safety class that we looked at was, so flour is very combustible. So flour explosions and sugar explosions are a thing.
Sugar, I knew that. Flour, I've never heard of.
Flour. So it's the same concept as sugar. Basically, you get all the dust in the air, and dust in the air is very explosive for a lot of dusts. So in flour and sugar processing plants, if you don't have a good vacuum system or whatnot, you have all that flour in the air. Or cotton, I've heard from like old, there's a movie that I watched, it's a period drama, but cotton in the air before, like on the old spinning mill plants, that right. Could have been a problem. All these things you don't really think of as explosive hazards. Are
like sugar and flour, like really
right, like household things. But you know, if you dusted a bag of flour around your kitchen because you know you drop it and it goes everywhere and then you light a match, you're gonna have a problem.
Well, that's like, you actually think about it, you go back and you think everybody did that. What was it? The volcano experiment when you were a kid, where you were just like baking soda and vinegar that you add together. And it just, you know, it's like two household items that are constantly in the house, you know, right. You think, but it creates this massive, just, you know.
Right. That's what it wants to do. Yeah. So it's really, cause like that one's completely safe, but like you think about everything else you've got in your house.
Right. You have no idea what's going to react to what. And
don't mix things unless you know what mixing happens.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good call. My gosh, I can't even, like, number of times I'm kind of glad I didn't know this then. I would have panicked, but we had a run in with a troop of baboons that came through the kitchen one time, and they got into all the flour, and they were like, whoa! It was just like snowing. It was just flour everywhere. They were like, this is the best. They've got the flour and they got the pasta, and they were like, party. I mean,
I've heard that they like to go in and just like destroy and get into things. Like
they're small humans. They're, you know, they're so curious and they're smart. And so, like, rule of thumb is you just don't leave anything open. You don't leave the doors open. You don't leave the windows open. If the windows are open, they have to have like bars on it, small enough that things can't, like, a small
get through. Right.
Because they'll send in little ones for recon missions. No joke. Like, watched it.
Interesting.
And they figure out how to open doors. They're like us. They're just too clever. And so they find this stuff and they're like, well, this is not what we have out there. And I want to like test it. And then it just goes poof. And they're like, oh, it's like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. So they're just like, poof, 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 you know, and flour is going everywhere. And there's
also hasn't seen an image of a toddler in like a pile of flour, you know. Yes.
It's exactly the same. They're just like, this is amazing. This is something to play with. And then they, you know, then it gets wet and then they can do all kinds of weird things with the wind. You know, it's like watching a kid learn how something works, you know, for the first time. They're like, oh, you know, I didn't know it did that. Or I didn't know that's what that was. Or, oh, I was in a bag and now that it's not in the bag. Now it's like, ooh, you know, and things just, you know, you've experimented and you're curious. And so, yeah, who knew? Who knew that they could have caused explosions?
Yeah, and it does take a lot in the air. So it's weird. Like, there's this concept. It's there has to be enough particles in the air that they're basically close enough to catch each other on fire and explode, but not so many that like there's no oxygen. Basically, I think is the concept, because you know, fire's got that little fire pyramid, right? Fuel, oxygen. I'm blanking on the last one, energy maybe, but that's part of fuel. I'd have to look it up. It's been a while since I've been in that industry. But so like, if there's so much in the air, it's not going to explode. And if there's not enough in the air, it's not going to explode. So thankfully, like in your kitchen, it's probably going to be fine if your toddler gets into your flour, but I would light a match right after that happened just in case.
Right. That's interesting. I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy. I it's so fascinating that stuff that we sort of just take for granted and don't think anything of can be so dangerous.
I know. And then you read like the warnings on like your household cleaners, depending on what you use for cleaning. You're like, oh.
Yeah. Right. Should I be actually keeping this in the house? Like, should I maybe like,
I should actually wear gloves when I'm, you know, using whatever to clean off the stove or something.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And that's the thing is like, we, again, take it for granted. I mean, taking it for granted because we're used to just being able to fix stuff because everything's just sort of at our disposal. And when you don't have that stuff there to fix it, it's like, what do you do? It's like, you don't have Google to help you to be like, okay, I have just spilled this and I don't have any of this stuff. What do I do next? And then like somebody steps in and says, you're going to, you know, mix this household thing with that household thing. And then you'll fix everything. But it's, it's amazing. These like, just things that just seem like they're innocuous, that they just wouldn't be an issue. And suddenly you're like, I have just blown up my kitchen.
Right. Everyone knows the classic, you know, water on a grease fire.
Right.
Well, everyone should know that one. If they don't, go Google that and never do it. But like, yeah, there's some other things in your house that you just don't think about. And how many people actually have the recommended number of fire extinguishers in their house?
Or that they've checked their fire extinguishers.
Or that they've checked their fire extinguishers yearly, which you do need to do.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way,
I say that, and I think it's been over a year since I've done mine, so I should check mine again.
Yeah, that was one of the things we definitely had to do, and like it was a requirement in order to have reserves functioning. Is your fire extinguishers had to be checked every year. Like they had an inspector that would come in and make sure. It was like, it's so interesting that that's the thing that you guys are. But also, it's like, it's a fire. You know, if you have a, I mean, we have naturally occurring fires. Wildfires do naturally occur, but right. You know, you still need to be able to deal with them. So, and then, you know, we had things like controlled burns to sort of try to minimize when things were like, if you got a drought and there was just way too much brush to try to control it so that it didn't go crazy. But you need to be able to put it out. So if you can't do that, then things can go really bad really fast.
Oh, it's a farming technique too, right? To burn at the end of the season. And then...
because it's also apparently it's great. It's good for the soil to some degree.
But you still have...
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's pretty cool. Like all these things, like things that, I can't engineering and any of the chemistry was not my, I was interested, but again, not my forte, like math. I was a biology person, but,
I wanted to be a biologist for years. I decided I wanted to get paid.
Yeah. Good point. Part of the reason why I also didn't go into it.
I feel like that's the
instead, because that's really.
You're like, oh, I could go study animals. And you're like, oh, I'm dependent on grants for all of my funding. And that's how I get paid.
Yeah. It's a cool life. It is not the most lucrative in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Yeah,
I always say that about conservation. I'm like, yeah, it's not very different going from music to conservation. You don't make any money.
Right.
You might occasionally, you might get like a good, you know, just get lucky and somehow, but for the most part, like you're not going into it to be a, you know, to like for the ducats, you know?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I was going to be a marine, I wanted to be a marine biologist and I was going to study great white sharks. My parents were not happy about that.
For years it was dolphins for me. And then, it kind of, I had a really good chemistry teacher in high school. So by then it had morphed into chemistry. And then I wanted to go be like a chemist and my dad's an engineer. And he was like, you know, you don't need a PhD if you get an engineering degree and you can always go back later for your chemistry if you're really still that interested. And that was I got through undergrad chemical engineering. You went, oh gosh, chemistry is really hard.
Yeah.
No, I'm done. we're graduating, I'm done. Although now in the fall, I'm going back for my master's in systems engineering. So
that's exciting.
Yeah, it should be fun. I think it'll help me be more well-rounded since I am relatively new to systems engineering. So
I gotta think it's also fun to go back, like, to be introduced to something and then to go back into it now that you have some experience under your belt, like the way you see it when you first start out and you're like, oh my gosh, that is just overwhelming.
Yeah.
And like, I can't even imagine getting involved in that. Like I wouldn't even know the first place to start. It's like when you start anything new, it's like, I don't know what I'm doing and I'm just failing miserably. But then when you have some background to go into it and be like, ah, now this stuff makes sense. Like,
yeah,
I understand how this stuff fits together better. And yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I will say having helped mentor some new hires in my current role, the engineers with a master's are almost as useless, who just went undergrad to master's are almost as useless as the engineers who are just had their undergrad degree. Because without that real world experience, like there's so many things to learn in an office engineering job. Like,
yeah,
honestly, Outlook skills. Just Microsoft Outlook is like this thing that like no one, you don't schedule meetings in meeting rooms until you're in an office job and you know, so there's all those little skills and just also the skills of how to find the right people in your work environment to go talk to and get your job done. Like those are all skills that you're never going to really learn in a classroom.
Yeah. So the theory is great, but then we have to put everything in practice. And it's not even just the theory and the practice. It's the theory of sort of the job in terms of the intricacies of the job and like the nuts and bolts. But then it's like you said, the personal interaction side of things, the social side of things, which is you need to learn to interact with people in an office or in whatever, where you know, in a team, in a whatever it is. And the simple basic things of communication. Like I imagine this is the same for you from what you were saying, that one of the fundamental things in every single job that I have ever done, that I know of anyone ever doing. The most important thing is you have to be able to communicate with people.
Yeah. My dad used to do he works for NASA. So he used to come to my middle school and stuff and do classes, and he'd be like, English is the most important skill that an engineer has. If you can't communicate your ideas and your designs, you're useless. It doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, you become, I'm going to rag on Nikola Tesla a little bit, but you become a little bit like Tesla with his designs locked in a thing and, you know, getting beaten out by Edison, who was arguably better at communicating and getting people interested in funding his stuff.
And that's the thing. That's the hardest part about it, is it's not just that vacuum. You have to be able to cross over. And I know one of the challenges we run into with I think all fields, but conservation has run into quite a bit, is you have a lot of scientists in the field. They're brilliant. They're so good and they know their stuff, but they can't cross that boundary of being able to explain all these 12 syllable words to the average person. The average person's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, I can't even begin to comprehend what it is you want me to comprehend. And there's that disconnect. And it's like, well, you need, everybody needs to be on the same page. They don't have to know all of that, the 12 syllable stuff, but they have to understand what that means and how it relates to them.
Right. Yeah. Why do I have a retention behind my house? And, you know, what are they doing with that? Is, you know, for all that, you know, to relate directly to the environmental stuff, you know?
Right. Right.
If you don't understand what that's doing, then you think that there's just a mosquito infested swamp behind my house.
Which is a whole other thing, but
it's actually very full of frogs, so we don't get many mosquitoes. It's very nice. We have a healthy little ecosystem of a retention pond.
Yeah, I used to love that we had bats in our roof. That, and I know most people don't like bats, but I'm like, I love them. They eat bugs. We have no bugs,
and they're cute. They're little, especially the little ones, because you don't think about how there's some big bats. Yeah. But the cute little ones that you see flying around, I think they're adorable. You know, obviously you can't pet them or anything because they carry rabies, but
right. Well, we had them, the babies would fall through our roof, so we'd event during the certain time of year we literally would be scooping up babies, and you couldn't bring them up to the roost at night because they were this particular species, or these species were nocturnal, and if you brought them up it would screw up the whole colony. So we would be nursing baby bats for the night. We'd have baby formula and a little eyedropper, and we would be, let's see if I can find a picture. I'll show it to you. They were so
That's
cute.
Adorable.
They were ridiculous. And people are like, oh, hey, bats are awful. I'm like, you just don't know. Aww. They are the cutest, and they have the tiniest little nostrils, but they're adorable, and they're so useful. And I think that's what's so frustrating. I love all of these species that most people don't like. I love hyenas. I love vultures. I love bats. I'm like, they've served such an important purpose, and y'all are not hating on them because they're not cute. I'm like, come on. But yeah, the baby bats were, we named them Bruce and Wayne.
Oh. Perfect. I don't know what else to name two bats, actually. Right? I think that's just where they have to be named.
There was a female that we called Angelina, who was also adorable. Wait, I might even have the video of Angelina. Let's see if I can share this with you. Oh my gosh, I have my whole computer, it's embarrassing. My whole computer is legit, animal pictures.
Okay. Nothing wrong with that. Mine's full of my cats, but that's just two cats, not nearly as interesting as hyenas, so.
I don't know, cats are actually pretty, domestic cats are they're honestly just small versions of the wild ones. I promise
you. I know.
They're so funny.
I let my cat out because I thought the chipmunk would run faster, and then I had to rescue a chipmunk from my cat a couple weeks ago.
Oh, that's rough.
I know. I felt bad. It was my fault. I was like, oh, there's no way. The chipmunk's just going to jump off the deck. I didn't think the chipmunk was going to go down the stairs, and my cat was able to catch it on the stairs, so I had to free it. The chipmunk is fine. There's eight of them eating the bird seed on my deck. They definitely, they're just little tiny. I love all the photo comparisons, that cat stretch thing, and you see the big cats doing the same thing.
Oh my gosh. I worked at a cheetah rehabilitation place, and the cats with the ball and feathers, they did this at boxes. Big cats love dogs. They look like cardboard boxes too. All right. So wait, here, this is Angelina. I have to, you're going to die. She was so cute. Can you see her?
She's so tiny. Yeah, I can.
She was so little. I loved her. I didn't want to give her back.
Right. I mean, you have to, but like so tiny. That's adorable.
I know. And they're little tiny itty bitty. I mean, then you know, the nostrils.
Thumb-sized. It's great.
So little.
I can totally see their adorable little flying creatures. I don't know why anyone wouldn't like bats. Let's be real. Unless I get like the surprise of them being in their house, like bats out in the wild and mice out in the wild are definitely cuter than mice in my house. But overall, they're adorable.
But I also think it's a lot of like we have a habit of not liking things we don't understand. And I think because, I mean, bats, it's crazy. Like you look at, they have wings, you know, they're mammals, but they have wings. And that's just kind of weird.
That evolutionary branch took a different turn than the rest of us.
Right. They were like, we're going to make our hands wings. Y'all have fun doing what you're going to do. We're going to fly. So have a good time. You know, working where we were working, because we're used to dealing with, like, I had to get rabies shots in general, just because I was out dealing with this constantly.
I think it would help when you don't have to be as scared of them knowing that they commonly carry rabies. I don't know what percentage bats carry rabies, but I know that bat bites, you need to go get your rabies shot.
So the percentage is actually, okay, in terms of vector animals that carry rabies, they're a high level relative to like rats and raccoons and bats and what else carries, like, please don't forget. Anyway, it's not that high of a percentage. It's actually very few bats actually carry it. It's just that they are one of the main vector species that does carry it.
Well, and since rabies is one of those that if you don't get treatment fast enough, you're dead. Just assume that all bats have rabies, because that's the safest way to treat bats.
Yeah. So you should never, like, honestly, you should never pick up a bat. I mean, the only reason we could is because I like worked with rehabilitation and like knew things that needed to be doing and like how to properly hold them. I wouldn't pick up the adults at all. Like the little ones were so small that they didn't even have teeth. So, and it was just, you know, obviously hold them and put them in towels, keep them warm, and then wash your hands. It's like, no, wash your hands consistently and constantly. And then the morning we would bring them up into the attic and put them back up at the roost with the family. And it's like nothing happened. And then like 3 days later, more baby bats would fall through the roof.
I didn't realize that they had such a falling problem.
Well, I don't think they normally have such a falling problem. Our structural we lived in what was an old abattoir. And so it was literally called the blockhouse because it was legit just a block and it was just kind of concrete. And there was an upstairs area, but you couldn't get upstairs. There wasn't a staircase. You can only get upstairs from taking the ladder to the outside windows, which weren't even windows. They were just shutters.
Okay.
None of it was insulated. None of it was closed off. And the floor was essentially the ceiling / floor. So the ceiling from my house to this floor of the top floor thing was literally just like tar paper and bamboo that was just, So what would happen is like mom would go out to go get food and babies would be like, oh, where did mom go? And then they'd go ruffling around and then they'd fall through the hole.
Right. Cause they're not necessarily in whatever bats in that area live in. I don't know. I think of them in caves, but I don't know that all bats live in caves. So
no, that's why they live in attics. They live in like tree hollows.
Tree hollows. Right. Yeah, so those don't have like the, you know, falling through the surface issue.
Yeah, it's not usually a problem for them. And then also that a lot of times the moms will take the babies with them. Like if they're young enough, the babies will literally be here holding on to mom, and mom's flying around and the baby's like,
they just have to hold on really tight. Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, it's adorable. And then you have fruit bats, which are obviously they're dire and all this, so they're during the day and they're not eating insects, but the babies will also typically, like you'll see them just hanging from rafters. And the babies will be tucked into mom's wings. They're kind of adorable.
That's cute.
Yeah, they're really cute. Anyway, so we're literally already at an hour.
All right.
So we can keep talking.
You know, that's just how it goes with us. We're just going to talk about, you know, bats and chemical issues.
It's all good. I definitely keep talking. So out of curiosity, if you're like, for a kid going into, so is this sort of what you were looking, when you were a kid, what did you want, besides biology, once you decided no more biology?
Yeah, I mean, it was always kind of going to be a science field, and there was definitely a break between biology before I decided on chemical engineering, because I didn't really pick chemistry was like junior year of high school. I honestly don't remember what that break was. It was just kind of like a general, I'm going to be going into science. Hmm. I don't remember anything like specific. I just, you know, kept struggling through math. So I will say, like, if to anyone who's looking at watching this and thinking, you know, I suck at math, like, you aren't that higher level math that you may not be great at is not in all engineering jobs.
Right.
So, you know, if you're terrible at calculus and you think I can't be an engineer because I, as long as you can get through your calculus classes, I have not used calculus since. So, yeah, I knew it was going to be science. I knew it wasn't going to be math because I was terrible at math. I liked history and stuff. I just didn't, that's not where I wanted to go get a career in. Partially because, I don't know, the stability of STEM is always a good selling point as far as, you know, careers go. So, yeah, it just kind of, I liked chemistry in high school, and then Dad was an engineer and he was like, just go get your engineering degree. It's easier. Just kind of what I did, and it helps that I was in the Midwest, which had a bunch of good engineering schools.
Yeah, often people don't say engineering is easier, just saying, but well done.
Well, it's easier than getting your PhD in chemistry.
Yeah, I get it.
You know, yeah, it wasn't easier than like a liberal arts degree or something. I mean, that's got its own challenges if you're not very good at writing. My sister got her liberal arts degree and is a lawyer now. She had her own different challenges, but like, yeah, getting an undergraduate chemical engineering degree was going to be easier than going straight to a PhD chemist degree.
Now, I love that you say that though, too, because I find that there's this, I always say STEAM, I don't even use STEM because I always feel like art is so...
It's been added now and I keep forgetting that it's the new acronym.
Oh, no, it's all good. But I remember hearing people sort of poo-pooing certain fields and being like, oh, well, that's just easy. That's like a joke one. And I'm like, it's only a joke if you're good at it. Right. Joke, you know, it's like I did art class. Some of my art classes in school were the hardest classes that I had. My music theory class was one of the hardest classes that I had to take.
Yeah.
Like, economics class was also one of the hardest. But it's like, it is more about, you know, I have had friends that they're like, I couldn't for the life of me do some of the stuff that you do. I just doesn't, that's not how I function. And so I always find it really important to like impart to people that every degree, every area of study has its challenges.
Right.
It all has its, none of them are easy.
Right. Yeah. Like all the English degrees and stuff are, you know, writing a gazillion papers, and, you know, engineers like to make fun of the business school, and yeah, the math is easier, but there's a whole lot of like, who actually liked econ, you know?
I did like macro. I hated macro. I hated microeconomics.
I don't even remember which one I hated. It was like, this is not for me. I'm moving on with my life now.
Yeah. No, I think because I like macro in general, but like macro stuff, like big picture stuff.
Yeah.
But, oh my gosh, micro was like my nightmare. I used to sit there and be like, can I drop this class? Like, what would I... class.
Yeah.
But
no, yeah. I was one class away from like a minor in Latin literature. And those classes were different hard. I'll say I did better in them because, like I said, English has always been one of my better subjects. So I was better at writing the papers and stuff. But I mean, they were definitely hard in a different way. There's a whole different set of critical thinking skills in those English degrees than you get in engineering. Engineering is very, you know, there's a lot of times this is how it's going to work. Your math problem's only going to be solved one way, whereas your English paper can be written 80 different ways, and you have to figure out and coherently put your thoughts on a page.
I always found like with education in general that we should be as divergent as all encompassing as possible, and I think that was. I went to a Jesuit university where the ethos is essentially creating the well-rounded person to go out and serve the world.
Right.
And so fundamental, like your foundation classes, you had to have two histories, two theologies, two social, and was this like theology, social sciences, regular earth science type things. I guess earth is the right word. I don't know. Two maths, two, like you had to have your core curriculum before you even could get into your major.
Right.
To have this fundamental, because their whole idea was you have to have a basic understanding of everything in order to be able to move forward in life and actually, because that means you can connect with people.
Right.
You have this ability, like you said, like the way somebody writes, you could do writing so many different ways, and there's so many like ways to deal with a writing course versus an engineering course where it's a whole different method of solving a problem.
Right. And now my job is the intersection of that, where I'm writing right. for engineering, which is a whole other
right.
ball game where words become very important.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have to be honest. I feel like that's all people should really have that skill. Like, I feel like that is probably the most important skill that you could develop as a human being, period, is to be able to talk to people and connect the dots, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically at some point in time you hit a level in engineering where you're not going to get promoted anymore if you can't communicate either to internal or external customers.
Right.
Like, and that's, it comes faster than you'd think. like even in my job, I've been on customer, calls and stuff. Like, it's already like, I'm not a super high level engineer. I'm, a couple of steps past, beginning engineer. So yeah, it's definitely a skill that you need to have. And I think a lot of engineers forget or don't like to think about it because English wasn't their good course. They were in math and science, and that's where they excelled. So they were going to go be an engineer.
Yeah. And like I say, it's a language though. So you still have to be able to speak a language, and I feel like if you can learn one, you can learn another.
Yeah, except I keep trying to like pick up a second language, and I never get very far.
Yeah, well, there's only so much time also in the day and life in general. It's hard. There's so much stuff going on. Even now, everyone's like, I'm bored. I'm like, how? How are you bored? What are you doing? Like, what do you do with your life normally that you're bored? I have no time ever.
I'd be like, oh, great, I'm not commuting every day anymore due to Corona. So now my hobbies have somehow just expanded to fill my time.
Oh my gosh, I was actually thrilled. I was like, thank God the world is slowing down a little bit because I can't catch up. It's like, so you essentially, with what you do, you cross over. When I try to explain to people that I talk to with, like, I work on a creativity workshop with art and science, like connecting art and nature. And everyone's like, oh, they're totally different. I'm like, no, they're not. And creativity is an individual, much like communication, it's an individual skill that each of us has their own sort of thing. And you have very creative hobbies. Yeah. And you care, I find it's kind of fascinating when people think that you're either this or you're that. And you're the absolute blend of the two. And so what carries over, do you think, between the two of them? Like, what sort of skills and traits do you think work in both categories?
Want to hear the story where my hobbies actually solved a problem in the manufacturing plant?
Yes, I do.
So there's an ammonia scrubber in the plant I used to work in. It basically, so you don't want to discharge ammonia into the air, that's bad, and the EPA gets very grumpy. So it's just this whole big complicated chemical engineering process that pulls the ammonia into liquid, so you're venting air that doesn't have ammonia in it, and you've put the ammonia into something else and neutralized it and discarded it in a different way that the EPA is okay with. So there's filters in there as part of that system. And we have to change the filters, I don't know, every couple of weeks or so. And at some point in time, we got a new shipment in, and all the filters started foaming. Like, they'd foam for days, and they'd clog up the system with this foam. And I was like, weird. And, I'm like, this doesn't make sense. And so, when you're sewing and stuff, you start to learn about fabric treatments and stuff. And you know that there's, pre-treatments on your fabric and stuff. And some of those cause foaming. So eventually, I'm like, I think it might be the fabric, the filter treatments, because the filters are a type of fabric, basically. Kind of. They're cotton. I was like, I think there might be something changed and they're not removing that foaming agent from the filters anymore. So we called the manufacturer and they're like, oh yeah, there's two types. We've been shipping you the pre-washed ones that had all of that washed off. And lately we've been getting the ones that aren't washed. The part numbers were the same, which is a different issue for that manufacturer on why they have the same part number for washed and unwashed filters. But so like it had been a puzzle for weeks in the plant, and every time we changed filters, it was foaming and causing issues. And my hobby just happened to be like, oh, wait, let's call the manufacturer. Because if we hadn't known to ask that question, because the part numbers were the same, we might not have ever gotten a real answer onto why suddenly our filters were foaming in the ammonia scrubber.
That's amazing. That's all. Like, that's such a great story. That's a great story.
So sometimes they interact really well, and sometimes it's just been a creative outlet. So, I mean, I know, like, spatial awareness helps on, like, quilting when you're assembling a whole bunch of squares together. So that's definitely an intersection of, like, engineering and in quilting when you're putting all these blocks together to make a picture. On a more fun and creative side.
Right. But then also, even with the video game stuff, it's like, it's a whole system. It's understanding a system and how a system works. And I'm always fascinated when people are like, well, creativity, you know, like, I'm not creative. And they're like, well, I'm not, you know, I don't draw, I don't paint, I don't do whatever. And I'm like, that doesn't mean you're not creative. Like, it's creativity is a way of, it's just seeing the world. It's a curiosity. I would say it's a curiosity about the world. It's wanting to understand the world and how things work and finding ways to address it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, even building a robot's creative, you know, right. Think of that as an engineering activity, but there's a gazillion ways to build a robot that does one thing, and how you solve that is your creativity.
Right. Right.
You know.
Yay. So, all right. So random question, and this is completely unrelated, but kind of related. If you were to take all the animals in the world and turn them into jobs, what would your job animal be?
Ooh. That's a really tough question. I'm trying to think, like, I don't know, like, the first things that was popping into my head, and I don't know why, was like ferrets and crows, because they just kind of hoard materials. But I think that's more because my crafting hobbies has me hoarding materials, not so much that my job has me.
I don't know, though. That would
but although crows have their whole, like, system and social structure. So maybe we can go with a crow, because as a systems engineer, I'm definitely working the social structure thing that crows have, because they're super intelligent and fun.
I can see that. I can definitely see that. They work together, work in groups, and they constantly are problem solving and figuring things out.
Right. And, yeah. And they're really clever about it. And we just think of them as birds, but they're actually really cool birds. Oh, definitely witches familiars for a reason.
Yeah. Right. No, they're brilliant. I love crows. There's a New Guinea, New Caledonian, the New Caledonian crow. Have you ever heard the stories about them?
No. Okay, unless so they're the ones that you can train to do fun things.
They are tool users.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So I didn't know that some of them were.
And it's fascinating, because if you actually look up some of the studies on them, like, it different, like, New Caledonia is a small area in sort of Southeast Asia, and, like, different populations of them know different tools. Like, they figure out different ways to solve the same problem.
Right.
It's a cool thing. But that's so.
That's definitely engineering, then. It's definitely crows.
Yes, because you got the right animal. So
we're all figuring out different ways to solve the same problem of, you know, how to do whatever today's engineering problem is.
Right. But they also have that ability to see the overview, to see the big picture.
Right.
Say, okay, what's our challenge? How do we use what we have to go from point A to point B and solve, or point whatever it is, and solve problem? So
right.
You're a crow.
Perfect. I love it. I like
they're
them.
Brilliant. They're awesome.
I keep looking out for them and seeing if they're in my area, but they keep hiding from me. I get all sorts of other birds, but I don't see the crows very often.
Oh.
I hear that you can, like, get them to recognize you if you, like, give them gifts and stuff.
They'll bring you presents.
Right. I want crow friends. So I keep keeping an eye out to see if I can start befriending the crows, but
they did a study, and actually it was interesting. They did and they remember, and they teach. They teach other crows.
Yeah, I heard that, like, their future generations will remember you.
So you don't
their parent crows.
Yeah, they did a whole study of them. I don't remember. I think it might have been in Washington State, maybe Oregon, that they were doing a study on them. And they were wearing, some people were wearing masks, and some people weren't wearing the mask. And the person who was one of the people that was doing some sort of testing, whether they were catching them to ban them or whatever it was, and they just didn't, the crows didn't like it. So they remembered his face, and they told all the other crows. And so, like, the following year, the new baby crows knew to not like that guy.
That's awesome.
I'm never going to live this down. I'm legit never going to live down my work.
Right. And now you're, you know, the crows all hate you and you have to move to a new area because the crows are teaching future generations.
Right. To be like that guy? Yeah, no.
No, not cool.
Anyway. All right. Thank you so much, Kelly. I appreciate it. This has been so much fun.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun.
I will have to find the picture so I can email them to you. You Perfect. Can enjoy the little baby bat noses and butts.
They're adorable. Right. Probably better than me Googling bat butts later because I don't know where that goes.
Yeah, so. I recommend not doing that. There's you never know.
Right. I'm not sure where that leads and I'm not sure I want to find out.
I don't want to. Awesome. All right. Well, have a wonderful evening.
Yep. And I'll send you the links I was talking about for the MIT and the Discovery so you have them.
That would be awesome. And the other is robotics is, that would be great. And all.
Oh, the FIRST Robotics. So yeah, that's normally a school club that I can send. I think they've got a landing page website and people can always start their school clubs.
That's cool. Awesome. All right.
Yeah.
I'll hopefully see you at some point soon.
Yeah.
I know.
We always have a fire pit and you guys have one too. So.
We do too. And by the way, the backyard is like a jungle now. You should see all the.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, for the garden?
It just exploded. Speaking of explosions, it is amazing. It's like getting taller than me.
Nice. Successful garden then.
Yeah. So thank you. Cool. All right. Tell David I said hello.
Will do.
I will talk to you soon.
Bye.
Good night.
Thanks so much for tuning in and joining us today. If you want to check out some of the links that Kelly recommends, the MIT graduate course she talked about is called Fundamentals of Systems Engineering. Discover, which is the Resources for Child Engineering Projects, is www.discovere.org. Then there's Piper Computing, where you can literally build a computer, and FIRST Robotics. I'll be sure to include the links in the podcast notes. If you want to keep up to date on what's going on with the series, visit lateshiftmedia.com. Late Shift Media is also where you can go to find out about upcoming episodes and future guests, and where you can sign up to stay up to date with the series. Again, it's lateshiftmedia.com. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you have an amazing day.